Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes. Drew Meredith, welcome to this episode of the Australian Investors Podcast.
Good to be back.
It is indeed. We're talking reporting season, really in the thick of it now. We've got the meat in the middle section of reporting season. So we're going to cover five, maybe 10 companies today. Some of the companies include Altium. I might throw in a few small caps. Drew's going to cover Boral, Kogan, Hub, Coles, Endeavour. A good list there. I know there's a lot of interest in Endeavour because of the demerger. That was in the news recently. I don't know much about it other than I sometimes go there to buy wine.
And pubs.
And pubs. There you go. Yep. We might also talk about Netwealth, seeing that we've got the Hub connection in there. Cochlear came out with some decent results. EML is a bit of a basket case, which I'll cover in just a few moments. And we'll just get cracking into it, I guess. So, mate, I can't remember who went first last time. Maybe you go first.
Put me into it.
What do you think of when you think of Boral?
Me, I think cement, but I don't think anyone else thinks that.
Yeah.
We're kind of proud. When we build direct equity portfolios for our clients, we're proud how boring our portfolio of stocks is.
Yeah, right.
You literally know what every company does and they're easy to forecast. They're easy to understand. I mean, Boral is construction materials and essentially concrete. They own quarries. They had a whole heap of overseas businesses for quite a while. They've sold those off at various times, went from, you know, expanding into everything to going back to their core. Pretty common in listed markets, unfortunately.
It is.
And I mean, the result was pretty mixed. They initially fell by something like 12 or 13% when Adelaide Brighton, people would have heard of the same group. Yeah. Pronto Cement, I think, is one of their brands. They initially fell by more than 10% or about 10%, I think, when Adelaide Brighton reported, but actually rallied when they reported their own result. The issue, I think, was revenue was up only 1%, and that was despite massive demand for, you know, renovations, freeways. Everywhere you go at the moment, there's roadworks and cement goes into all those. But they were hit, whilst that was strong, they were hit by rainfall. So New South Wales and Queensland had a whole heap of shutdowns across construction industry. When I think the La Nina weather patterns hit and construction lockdowns, as we know, we try to forget about the lockdowns that happened over the last 2 years.
Especially here in Vic.
Yeah, but that hit them in the financial year. So the result was earnings fell 19%. Their statutory profit was $960 million, but underlying was only $107 million. And it's really this big shift. So for context, Seven Group, bought... They now own something like, I think it's 80% of the company, but didn't do a formal takeover, and they're listed on the ASX. So they've gone through this simplification, almost just becoming a cash producing, returning money to shareholder business.
So wait, so Seven Group own, how much of?
70 to 80%, I think.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So they crept up the share register, started buying more, didn't lodge a formal offer, and essentially it's a listed company that has a small free float, which isn't that uncommon overseas, but it's a bit less common here. Mm. So you're effectively investing alongside Stokes family and that group.
Right. Thankfully they do own it and they've saved shareholders some of the misery. Because since 2000 and what's this, the year 2000, it was $2.07. It's now $3. 22 years later. Has it paid a lot of dividends in that time?
I did have a massive... So, this is a part of the problem with being ASX. We were talking about this during the week in the office, was that you're always searching for growth and shareholders always want more growth. So, you go out and acquire a lot of different businesses.
Mm.
And at various times, it turns out well and doesn't. And they're at a point where they did that. It went well for a while and the share price was quite high, and then realized how hard it was to run multiple businesses, and now they're kind of in the reverse phase. So, they had a massive capital return earlier this year. That's where the share price dropped by, I think it was about 30-35%.
Yeah.
They sold US businesses and joint ventures to clean up and focus on cement and infrastructure. So, that was the big one. The dividend's fairly consistent.
Yeah, during like the GFC era, the 2000s and 2007, 2008, they were paying 34 cents per share in dividends. So, had your original cost base been, you know, $2, it's pretty hefty capital return over the years, and I assume a lot of franking credits along the way.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you've paid it back in dividends a few times over by the looks of it. That's just the share prices languish. Like you said, a few changes here and there, a couple of big shark tooths along the way. Goes up, goes down.
And it's one of those companies that I think it's exposed to a good theme that's occurring everywhere in the world, and that's, you know, rebuilding infrastructure, building new bridges, investing in kind of finding productivity. And we've seen a part of that in the housing sector over the last 5 or 10 years as well.
Yeah, absolutely we have. Okay, so Boral, if you're going to give it a score, say like A+ through to fail, what would it?
From the share price reaction, it's probably a fail.
Yeah.
But in context, the CEO is leaving, shareholder owns 80%, or main shareholder owns 70%, sorry. So, probably a slight pass if you know it's a reset. And the underlying parts of the business actually look pretty good. They're talking about work they've got coming with West Sydney Airport, Sydney Metro, Sydney Metro West, and a whole heap of projects, infrastructure projects that have taken a while to come to fruition. So,
Okay, cool. Well, from one to another, EML Payments is the quote-unquote fintech enabler, is what people call it. And they, as I mentioned last night on Selfwealth, it's pretty much what everyone, that's the moniker that everyone gives to it, fintech enabler, when they don't know exactly what it does.
So, it's not prepaid cards, is it?
Yeah, it does prepaid cards. Yeah, it does that, plus a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
Makes money through breakage, like if you have a gift card that expires worthless, through clipping the ticket, does a lot of like welfare type stuff. For example, if you need to get stimulus out and you can credit people really quickly through these virtual accounts that they put together. It's a roll-up of companies because it's bought a few different companies over the years. This is like on Twitter right now, in the Twitterati, this is the number one meme stock. So, but for the wrong reasons. It's not going up, it's going down. And
it has profit. And cash flow.
It's got cash flow. profit, it's, yeah, I mean, this is a very complex business. So, they've account that in Europe, in the UK, elsewhere, they've got account-to-account payments. Here in Australia, they've got reloadable gift cards. They're the market leader for fringe benefits. So, if someone is in healthcare, a partner is in healthcare that does this, or maybe you're in healthcare, you've experienced this, does a lot of the like the malls. So if you need a, you know, like a Westfield card, for example, that might be used at the stores. Like any of the stores, you would use this. And fintechs use it because they take away the complexity of developing your own payments ecosystem, basically. But one of the things that's happened is they've made a few acquisitions over the years, particularly in Europe, that have come back to bite them. In terms of, so the ways you can monitor the company include gross deposit volume, or GDV, so the amount of money going into the EML ecosystem. That was up 308% to $80 billion, but the big reason for that was an acquisition of Centennial in Europe, which I'll get to in a minute. Revenue was up 21% to $234 million. Profit, aka loss, was negative $4.8 million. That's up from a loss of $29 million the year before. Gross profit went up, but so did expenses.
That's a 500% improvement.
Well, it depends. Can you multiply negative numbers? the outlook is pretty binary. And the reason that I say that is the CEO left, you might have seen this in the news, the CEO left, Tom Cregan, interviewed him on the podcast here, on the Australian Investors Podcast. And he left with like one business day's notice, and he'd been there since 2012.
Yeah.
He was replaced by Emma Shand, who I think is still in Australia, but maybe based over in Europe for a little while they deal with a bunch of regulatory issues with the Central Bank of Ireland. And now more recently, so there was the earnings call, and then, which was great, actually. It was the first time we heard from Emma. She's conducting a thorough review of the company, and it'll be presented to shareholders in November. She's a pretty well-credentialed executive. So that all happened. That took place with Rob Shaw, CFO, on the call a week or so ago. But then what happened is this week the company came out and went into a trading halt and titled the announcement something like Centennial Fraud Incident.
Exactly right. I've got it open.
Yeah. And so what happened is, and I'll quote, EML is taking steps to investigate and understand the circumstances surrounding the fraud and has commenced steps to recover any losses. EML is confident that the maximum amount of any losses will not exceed 5.5 million euros, but maybe lower depending on the success of recovery actions. So this has come after the Central Bank of Ireland has clamped down on them and forced them through this remediation program and this like compliance program, which has been a huge headache for EML. And then this is with another business that they acquired. So two acquisitions now in Europe that have come under scrutiny, and this couldn't come at a worse time. I put out a tweet, like you've always got to be careful when you put out a tweet, but this one in particular, I said, have we reached the point of maximum pessimism for EML? And then this announcement came out a day later.
It's up 2% today, so maybe we have.
Well, there you go. What's it down from, like $6?
I can see 4 in the last 12 months, so down 75, 80%. I mean, it probably got similarities to Boral, to be boring, which is, you know, acquiring, having multiple businesses in multiple countries. And Boral had, a fraud incident in their Windows business where the financials of that business didn't stack up. So it's hard to be in control of every business that you're managing.
Yeah, it can be. Absolutely. Particularly in these larger businesses. Like we expect that CEOs know everything about everything, but at the same time, just a really complex business to model. And every time I do a discounted cash flow over this business, I think to myself, it looks pretty good. It looks pretty good. It looks pretty, and I just keep following it down. Yeah. Like the running joke on Twitter at the moment is, here's how I invested in EML over the last 5 years, and then it's just blank.
Well, it's growth kind of hit that, didn't it, since the pandemic? Like revenue growth, cash flow, everything was growing, particularly if they were helping fintech. So all these issues are kind of hidden in light of a massive top line revenue growth.
Yeah. One of the things that, and this would be really hard to do your DD on if you're acquiring, is when they acquired the prepaid financial services business. This is a business that they acquired in the UK a few years ago. Just before COVID, it was announced. That, because of Brexit, they had to relocate that business basically. So that business relocated to Ireland, which has a different set of like regulatory standards. And so when they relocated, that's when all the issues arose with like compliance and anti-money laundering and all that. And this other one, which is Centennial, which has the NewPay brand under it, and that's account-to-account payments, kind of like our OSCO or Beamit or whatever here in Australia. And the problem is that wherever there is like instant money transfers, particularly through geographies, you're going to attract money laundering. There's no question.
Yeah.
So whoever's like the next in line for launching an app, be warned that you are going to get people try and use your platform for money laundering. And that's where EML's become a bit unstuck now. So overall, I've rambled long enough, but I know it's one that people want me to cover. I mean, it's a binary outcome from here for me. I think, you know, I said 3 days ago, is it maximum pessimism? Well, maybe it could get worse from here. But I would say that, you know, it's one where you have to tread carefully, just prepare for a lot of volatility. A couple of companies had looked at it for acquisition and have walked away. We don't know why. There's been very little light shed on that. So for me, very, very high risk. I mean, that's probably where I'd leave it.
That's probably one of the reasons. So when we build portfolios and if we're investing in something like this, it'd be part of a fund or a manager who's got the ability to attend every call, go to Ireland, have a look at what their businesses are doing. Because if you're doing it yourself, you could probably do it for 10 companies and have a good idea. But it's very hard to invest direct and know this is coming.
Yeah. I mean, and still, like, some of the best fund managers, I'd say, in Australia have still held on to this or had it. Not some of the best, but many of, like, the tech-oriented fund managers have allocated to EML.
Yeah.
And the CEO, former CEO Tom Cregan, you know, spoke very well, had pretty good vision for the business and had done pretty well up until the two acquisitions. So, one for the watch list. And if you're on Twitter, you can enjoy it. That's number one for me, mate. What's number two for you?
Probably been pretty negative on this company for a while, which is probably because I missed out and didn't buy it a dollar when it went up to 13. But Kogan.
Oh, yeah.
I think we talked about this a few times. It's always seemed to be a challenging business. I bought a few things there. Everyone that kind of knows what Kogan does, you call them the Amazon of Australia. Maybe that's a pretty big compliment. but you don't. This one stood out because you don't often get an apology from management that says, you know, we got something wrong. I was trying to find exactly what they said. There was no sorry there, so it wasn't an apology that actually had sorry in it. We were wrong, is what you got. So essentially, I mean, if Target in the US, one of the biggest retailers in the world, can do it, you can't really blame Kogan. But essentially, they said, we saw this massive growth in demand and online sales for all of our various products, whether that was, you know, electronics to other random things. And as a result, they spent a massive amount of money on inventory because they thought that demand was going to continue. Turns out when people were locked at home, they shopped more than they would. So I had a quick look at the financials. It went from 112 million in inventory in 20 to 227 in 21 to 159 in 22.
So it went up like 100 and back 50.
Doubled, yeah. And I think the challenge there, though, and this is what you saw with Target and the same problem with them, is that when you've got too much inventory, you have to sell it. The only way to sell it is to cut the price even more. And if you're already a low-cost seller, your margin just disappears. So I think they went from a slight profit to a loss of 35 million and they kind of got savaged, and they've been savaged over a period of time by the market.
Their shares are down from a high of $24.75 to $3.59 at the time of recording.
I only looked back 12 months where it was 13. So this is one of those stories where, you know, even a company that's fallen 70% can fall another 70%.
Yeah.
I naturally want to buy companies after they've fallen. Yeah,
you anchor to the price, right?
I've told you that before, and I forcibly stop myself from doing that now.
You'd almost be better off, like, flipping that on its head. Find the companies that have gone up and just buy those ones.
That's what I do now, momentum.
Yeah.
It tends to work better. But everything else was, like, it actually is a growing company compared to everything else. So, you know, gross sales in their marketplace business were up 20%. Yeah, gross profit was down. Revenue was down for the main business. I think we talked, maybe it was a year ago or when we were in lockdown, about how they had gone into so many different verticals, which is always, it seems the commonality in the last three has been, you know, they started doing energy, they started doing phones, they started doing
super,
and that just seems losing direction and not focusing on what they're best at. Probably all right for Amazon to do that, but maybe not Kogan.
I remember when I bought a Kogan phone, I thought it was cheap. Saw my Android days. Android days sound like someone that's like talking of like a dark period in their life. I got the box for the phone. I pulled it out. It was from Hong Kong. It didn't come with an Australian charger.
Everything came from Hong Kong or China.
The whole thing. Yeah. Kogan. And I was like, damn it, I need to go find one of these chargers. I didn't even realize. But for the most part, like, I've had Kogan TVs. They've been pretty good, you know?
Most of it's fine. I got Kogan at home. We did see kind of issues where a couple of people in the office were trying to buy things in 21.
Yeah,
and they weren't arriving, or they were delayed a long time. Stuff, and anecdotally, you start to get worried, but the share price was still going up. So,
What's interesting, because I looked at the financials as well, is that, their profit went backwards in a big way, but their cash flow actually went forward in a massive way.
It was a $120 million turnaround in 2 years.
Because you're unwinding. I think it went from, forgive me off the top of my head, but the working capital position went from negative 60 million to positive 60 million in 12 months.
Yeah.
So the free cash flow looks like it's amazing.
Yeah.
But you'd only probably know that if you dig into the notes and you look at, like, you understand way working capital works.
It probably should have been $120 million if they were selling all the product at full price.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, they're going to have to shift back to a normal state of inventory. That marketplace thing, I actually dug a bit deeper into that too, which is interesting. I think the big push behind that Mark Kogan marketplace is that they bring sellers onto the platform who can basically manage their own inventory.
Yeah.
So you can sell on there, and they can base, and they'll integrate with like Shopify or Magento or whatever, you know, software you're using. And then that way you can sell on there, and then they don't necessarily have to take as much of the risk.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
And just take a cut.
Yeah. Just take a cut from accessing the audience basically. So yeah, I think it's really interesting. They've got a lot more Kogan First users, and they've got an ambition to get to 1 million users. They actually just recently increased their price of Kogan First to $79.99, I think it was. And they said it's because of costs and whatever, which you can understand. So it'd be interesting to see the pricing power there if people stick with it, even though there's a price increase. They had something like 84% renewal for the first cohort.
Yeah.
It's pretty high. I mean, they're the true fans. The first people to rock up to a free buffet are the ones who are hungry, right? So they'll renew first. But at the same time, if they can maintain that preference in buyer behavior, then it's interesting.
It was interesting they said they suspended their delivery service as well because it was getting too hard to do. Essentially, you know, you cost of trucks, you can't find drivers, right. And that was becoming a potential hit to profit as well. So
they just outsourced it to third parties and whatever. That's probably why the price has gone up.
Yep.
Yeah, right. Okay. Interesting. So Kogan, Rosalind Kogan, founder. Okay, cool. I like that. So numero two for me, I'll go with Altium. Altium makes the software. So I just want to be clear, makes the software for printed circuit board design. So if you've got any type of electrical component, I can see a lot here in front of me. They all need like a, if you think of that green thing that you pull out of a computer, which is normally the motherboard, think of that, but smaller, like it's got little transistors and whatever on it. You can use Altium software to design that. And it's increasingly being used by large teams. They've got a Nexus product, which is basically their core designer software for teams. And it's all cloud-based, the new versions of it. And they've shifted to a subscription, which that transition often hurts because companies go from selling once-off software for a high fee to selling ongoing software for a lower fee, but better margin. It's better for the software developers that create the software though, because if you do an update within the software, it updates across the entire customer profile instantly, rather than if you have to send someone a disk or they install a new version or whatever. So for the most part, Altium's result was super strong. Revenue up 23% to $221 million, beat my estimates. Profit, $55 million, up 57%, huge operating leverage kicking in. Dividends for the full year, 47 cents, up 18%. The outlook, I would say, is very positive because they're guiding for 15 to 20% top line growth. The thing that's the way I think about Altium is inside of Altium, there's a division called Octopart. And Octopart, it's a search engine for components for PCB. So if you have like those tiny little transistors, you can go into Octopart and search for that component that you need. So if you're designing with Altium products, you're designing this new piece of electrical equipment, you can automatically go and find the product that you need. And then you can search the marketplace for that component. And it'll instantly give you prices from 1 to 1 million. So how many do you need, basically? And the reason why this is interesting is because it's like a traditional search engine, but you can use that as almost like a yardstick or a leading indicator for how the business is going. Because if you know that's getting a lot of attention and that they're making a lot of revenue from that division, it basically says there's a lot of activity going on inside the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And so that's a sign that things are coming back. And that grew really fast. So all in all, really positive results from Altium. I like it. I still think maybe they could have taken up the offer from Autodesk at $38 a share. I don't know what it is right now, but-
Is that still, they said no, pretty hard no, didn't they?
Yeah, $37.55. And that's after a big jump earlier this week. So I think my valuation is just over, it's around about $31, $32. So it's one of those businesses that it's a, Charlie Munger would say is, you know, or Buffett would say, you know, it's a wonderful business at a fair price. You'd rather that than a fair business at a wonderful price. So Altium is riding that vertical of Internet of Things.
Semiconductors.
Semiconductors, connected manufacturing where you can design and manufacture in the get-go, like think of gigafactories and all that.
And there's another one that was, you know, got caught in the tech sell-off. So what, went from 45 to 25
yeah.
in 2022 alone. And now it's, even yeah. though it's bigger, it's growing faster.
Yeah.
And it's actually selling things. So it's
yeah. Always- so it's a good business. $5 billion. Key competitors are Siemens, which owns Mentor Graphics, and Cadence Systems, CDNS is the ticker symbol on the NASDAQ. And there are a couple of others around the outside like Zukin, but they specialize in different things. So that's Altium, ALU on the ASX is the ticker code. That's my number two. What do you got for number three, Matt?
So this is one we use in Waddle quite a bit, which is Hub24. So they're an investment platform.
As in you use them for clients?
Yeah. And I actually have my own superannuation held with Hub as well. Not a recommendation.
Not a recommendation.
Essentially, it's an administration platform. So if you've got an SMSF, for instance, you can hold managed funds, oversee shares, direct stocks, and all the tax reporting will be done for you. You can implement it all through the same portal. It comes at a cost. So essentially, they make money out of charging you for that platform and all the reporting that comes with it. And then like any financial services company, they like Computershare, they have an arbitrage between what the interest they get on your cash account and the interest they pay to you as well.
So they can make a clip of that ticket.
A margin, essentially. So they might be paid 1.5 and they pay you one.
Yeah.
So it's regularly voted the number one platform. So you've got the big groups like Panorama, AMP North and these sort of groups. And then you've got these fintechs. You're talking about NetWealth, the early fintechs in Australia, NetWealth, Hub24, Praemium, and these groups that are quickly kind of attracting advisors who want more flexibility. So half the advisory industry's disappeared. Most of them used to be aligned to the major platforms and people want flexibility and want the ability to, you know, run efficient businesses and deliver advice quickly and cost effectively to clients as well. So that's what they're benefiting from. Their assets under management they had record inflows, so $11 billion more on the platform. The number of advisors using the platform increased by 14%, so that's 3,400 of 17,000 in total. Their market share grew. It's only small, so 3.9% to 5.1% market share, but that's pretty big market share jump, and it's in a $60 billion under administration, not under management, sorry. And it's one of these businesses, like any tech company, once it gets scale, it goes straight to profit. Mm. So you spend a lot of money setting it up, getting the tech right. And that's why profit was up 130%, $35 million in profit. And revenue, platform revenue is up 59% to $160 million. And they doubled the dividend at the same time. They also bought this year Class, if you've heard of Class before, you might have had the CEO on.
No, they do the back-end reporting for SMSFs, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of like a turf war for data, essentially. The better data you get, the better providers you get, the more things you can add to make it life easier for clients and advisors, the more valuable you become. So it's been a super interesting one. I've always struggled to buy the stock because it's always traded on a PE, a high PE. But I think it was a pretty quality report.
Okay, so you're a financial advisor. You deal with clients. What made you choose Hub over NetWealth?
Flexibility. So one of the challenges you have with platforms is they don't allow every investment you might want to use on there. Hub24 was among the most flexible. They also allow global equities, which was something we were to be able to directly buy Amazon or Apple or ARK ETF, probably not the best example, but buy overseas ETFs at the same time. So it was that sort of flexibility and the kind of things we're looking for at the time. So we reviewed everyone. Pricing's all pretty similar across most platforms because it's a clear, transparent market. So it was more the flexibility and the engagement and the ability to request things and have upgrades made.
Right. So let's just have a quick look across the two, NetWealth and Hub here. Hub's got 3,486 advisors. This is a reporting date. NetWealth says its financial intermediaries is 3,327. So it's about, 150 behind.
Yeah.
You said what was the funds under administration on Hub?
Yeah, so the Hub and NetWealth would never manage funds. The advisors manage them. So they're usually called funds under administration. And that was $65 billion.
Yeah, right. Okay. With NetWealth, it was 55.6. So there, do those numbers from Hub include Class?
No, they include the mailing house service, which is a different kind of, basically they take your mail.
Okay, right.
Ordmanet, I think, used to run that. And that's 15 billion is included in that. So otherwise it'd be about 50.
Yeah, right. Okay. So just based on these numbers right here, it looks like you could maybe say Hub's just a little bit bigger, just a tiny bit bigger. So total income from net wealth was 173 million, Hub 192 million. But net wealth's more profitable at the bottom line, underlying NPAT of 56 million versus underlying NPAT for Hub at 36 million. So, yeah, I mean, is this an industry where you could just invest in both of them?
I think so. And then, interestingly, if you think something like computer shares are an inflation hedge, this kind of plays as an inflation hedge as well. They make comments about, you know, extracting profit as higher rates go up, they can actually generate more income as well.
Yeah.
But you don't always have to pick the winner. I think multiple winners can be here, and that's probably evidenced by, there was a research report that came out that interviewed financial advisors, and on average, each financial advisor has three platforms they use, not just one. So yeah, there's going to be more than one winner likely.
Yeah, right. So NetWealth and Hub 24, NWL for NetWealth on the ASX, HUB for Hub. NetWealth results were similarly strong. There was a transition. So they've always had this co-managing director or co-CEO situation, father and son duo, founding family. Now the son's just taken over.
Yeah.
It's been there since 2001. So yeah, I think for the most part, well-managed, aligned management team. They're going to favor dividends because they get dividends. Yeah.
I think we did some work with them back in 2005 or so, the Heinies. They were founded this company from nothing essentially and built it into, you know, 55 billion.
Yeah. It's just a beast now.
Yeah.
Should have invested back then.
Thanks. I think we got offered to.
Oh no. So it's $3.4 billion now, the company. Okay. So that's a good one. Hub. I'd say it's a pretty good result. Same with NetWealth. Why don't I go with, let's say Treasury Wines. Everyone loves red wine. So Treasury Wines is the owner of the Penfolds brand, Squealing Pig, and a bunch of other different premium wines now. They've, over the last few years, two major things have happened. The first one is China's tariffs, because of the trade war, just slammed shut the door on Treasury Wines' growth in mainland China. So that was, it's like Treasury Wines, that was the number one growth engine. And so now they had to pivot. They've looked at North America. And what they're also trying to do is they've split out Penfolds into a separate division. And they've made a few acquisitions to complement the premium end of the wine range. So no longer do they've sold off. This is the other thing. They've sold off their, what they call commercial wines, which are like their mass market, kind of middle of the range, everyone can drink it type thing. And now they're just focusing on premium wine. So they brought Frank Valley Estates in the US. They made another little purchase recently in Bordeaux. And they've got these three divisions. The things with Treasury Wines is they have a little bit of accounting difference. So to most companies, industrial companies that you come across, they report things like EBITs with an S on the end.
Cigara? Is it?
Yeah, Cigara. Yeah, sounds like cigar, but it's not spelt that way. It's SGARA. Which is basically they basically adjust for the value revaluation of like plants and aging of vineyards and that type of stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they comment on is this thing called NSR, which is, I think it's net selling revenue. And then they do that same thing for case. So, you know, a case of wine or whatever, to give you a sense of, I guess, the mix of the products that they're selling. So the total net selling revenue for the business actually went backwards 9.3%. Sorry, in Penfolds went back 9.3%. In their Treasury Americas business was flat, and in their Treasury Premium brands was also negative. In Penfolds, if you excluded China, was up 45%. Now, the interesting thing for the whole business is the net selling revenue per case was up 16% to $97. And this is the whole focus. Okay, we're getting rid of that commercial brand. Now we're going to focus on premium brands, which attract a higher price and should result in better economics for the business. Profit was up 5%. So 83% of their sales now are premium brands. And over the next little while, they're doing this cost out program, this cost efficiency program. They originally thought it was going to result in $75 million over the next few years of cost outs. It's now $90 million, I think, off the top of my head. I don't have the numbers right in front of me. Pays a dividend, expects margin expansion from the shift in the mix to higher priced products, but also cost outs. So I think for the most part, it was a good result from Treasury. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those businesses which has it's gone through some trials and tribulations, but for the very long term, it's actually been a pretty good, pretty compelling business. Performed pretty well in terms of share price, but also in terms of dividends to shareholders. So
it's a challenging one, isn't it, when China just decides to essentially close the door to all of Yuan. And it, you know, you kind of hope management would maintain more diversification of revenue. But when the market's so big and so profitable, you don't blame them in a listed market environment to get as much growth as they can. So I think, yeah, I mean, it looks like it's doing reasonably well and they've pivoted. Obviously, difficult to have foresight in how bad relations would get. So,
Yeah, I mean, the geopolitical issues, like if you look at, say, look at Altium, right? Altium has a Chinese business. There was a lot of ripoffs of its software in China, but it's still growing in Asia. And I think it just depends what type of thing you're selling, right?
Yeah.
So if you're selling wine and you're in a trade war, they can just say no thanks and go get it somewhere else. But if you're selling software, like mission critical software, that's probably the best in the world.
Or iron ore.
Or iron ore. They're like, don't think about that right now. We need that. For the most part, Treasury runs pretty compelling. I'd have it on my watch list right now, to be honest. Get a dividend. Long-term growth, if you drink Penfolds, I don't, but if you do, there's an added benefit. I don't know if there's any discount.
And you always see quick re-ratings when, you know, the risks kind of disappear and progress is being made. So it'll be on the nose incredibly badly for a while. And then once it turns incredibly quickly.
Absolutely. So that's my number three. What's your number four?
We'll stick with liquor. Not as much liquor, but it's nearly Friday.
2,400 companies on the ASX, and this is what we come up with.
The market's up again. Coles, so boring, but this is just reflective of the way we build portfolios. Coles isn't announced, but you know everyone knows supermarkets and liquor retailing. Company got smashed a bit. I think it was down about 8-9% on the day. Essentially, all management of Coles and Woolworths highlighted this during the pandemic that when they came out, sales growth wasn't going to hit the levels that it was because people weren't cooking at home anymore. So revenue growth was only 2%, and they refer to cycling, so not you know in your Lycra, but you're cycling out 12% growth. On the,
I had to think about what you meant there.
Yeah, like. I'm trying to be funny. Yeah. Profit, I mean, EBIT was flat. That's why the market didn't like it. Dividend only went up 3%. Comparable sales growth was only 3% higher. So that's the if you only had the same amount of stores. How these companies used to make money was open more stores, but eventually you get completely saturated. And then they start to open, you know, city stores or express stores and trial different things. I always find interesting when you change the way you're reporting and you're comparable. So like in funds management, you see this switch from when markets are bad, stressing long-term returns rather than short-term, and the table changes the opposite way from 5 years to 1 month.
Yeah, of course.
And they've done it by referring to the three-year compound growth of sales rather than just the last 12 months. And three-year looks great, 12 and 18% in supermarket and liquor sales. But it was only 2% in the last 12 months. So, I mean, I didn't think it was too bad a report. It's a you know a pretty stable company, you know, e-commerce sales. It's whether they can extract the you know the same level of growth and profit that they have in the past, and it's highly competitive. We still prefer Woolworths if you're going to buy the two. There's probably another one where you could hold both if you wanted to, and I always judge it on my local stores. If you walk into either one, does one feel tired or not? Because we know that's how Woolworths lost for quite a few years and how Coles has struggled more recently as well. So, and my local Woolies is better than my local Coles.
Interesting. Interesting. So, I was surprised at how much bigger Woolworths is in terms of market share in Australia.
Yeah.
There are a few studies online that show you how much bigger it is, but I always thought they were very like much neck and neck.
It was like 37 cents in the dollar. Every dollar go to Woolies.
Yeah, something like that.
And like in the high 20s maybe for Coles. And Aldi was much smaller than you'd think. I think it was about 8 or 10.
Yeah.
And took them 10 years or 12 years to get there.
So, okay. So overall, you think it was a decent result, although...
I think so. The share price, obviously, no one really liked the result because the share price fell 4.5% on the day. They're clearly worried about inflation. It could be more about outlook and comments from management. Cost of lettuce, the,
yeah, very important stuff.
How are you passing on that? And they've got all these strategies, like they call it smart selling, where they're trying different things, same trends across the country. So I didn't think it was too bad. I mean, the interesting part's their Ocado business, which is where you're trying to automate the picking and packing.
Yeah, right. Okay. I was wondering what that was. Okay. Because it's, I do see it mentioned a bit.
And they're going to spend $1 to $1.4 billion on CapEx, which is refurbing stores or building these in Melbourne and Sydney to try and, you know, expedite delivery.
Mm. I've heard now some Coles have like a full conveyor belt where it automatically scans your groceries. So, I mean, yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what they do with that $1 billion. It's a lot of cash to throw at Australian supermarkets, particularly in a time of high inflation. So yeah, well, this is a good segue rather than go back to me, just stay with you, to talk about Endeavour Group, which spun out of Woolies.
Yeah.
You're still playing in the same space, obviously. So just to fill anyone in that doesn't follow this space too closely, what did Endeavour get out of Woolies?
Pubs, Pokies and Dan Murphy's and a couple of the related brands, but essentially
all of the sin areas.
Pretty much. Although they talk about it in the ESG discount that kept Woolworths share price down and Endeavour not being fully valued. You probably talked about the conglomerate discount where the share price in Endeavour went up significantly after the spin out. It did fall on this report, but ESGs are environmental social governance. A lot of investors, if big funds didn't like Woolworths and were asking them to make change, I think, and they spun it out. And it's quite interesting. There was an article in the Fin that was talking about how much revenue actually comes from gaming, which isn't broken out specifically, because obviously poker machines are for a lot of people, that's something that they just won't invest in. So they said less than 50% of revenue came from hotels and gaming, but more than 50% of EBIT came from hotels and gaming, or from gaming specifically. Tells you, I think there was something in here. You know, most companies, you'd be happy with a 35-40% profit margin. Gambling is 85% profit margin. So that's why all the EBIT's coming from that part of their business. I mean, it was generally...
So they don't break it out, as in like they don't...
How much is from gambling? They'll say how much is from their hotels, but hotels also sell food and drinks and other things. So,
I don't know much about the business. I should know a bit more before we came on the show, but does it really matter? Because the reason I say this, is it for competitive reasons I don't disclose it? Because for ESG reasons, you kind of know what you're getting, right?
I think so.
Like, you know that it does pokies.
Like, some people might have a revenue, like a materiality of revenue that they won't invest in gambling over 10% or something like that. So maybe of revenue or a profit. So maybe it's very difficult to measure because there's something like 300 pubs. So you then have to get financials and break out for 300 pubs. Maybe that's easy.
Yeah. Well, it's just interesting, isn't it? Because I would have thought that they would have had that even when they did the split, you know?
Yeah.
People would know where that revenue comes from. So I'm just looking in sales. So I'm looking at, this is the annual 2022. A sale of goods in store, $8.9 billion. Of the total, $11.6 billion. Sale of goods online, $1 billion. Hotel-related goods and services, $1.5 billion. And this is in the segment disclosures and whatever. It's interesting because in-store sales and online control of goods, it doesn't really say exactly where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Just says, and then it's got the segment report. It's just got retail.
Yeah.
That says $10 billion of revenue.
Well, that's Dan's. So that'd be Dan Murphy's.
Hotels, $1.5 billion?
That's hotel. Yeah. Hotels is where your pokies come from.
Yeah. Right.
So that's where all the earnings are, not necessarily all the revenue.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Interesting. I think it's interesting. Okay. If you don't Endeavour, please let us know what was said.
The trends were pretty positive. Like they were talking about, you know, pubs are full, bands are running, everything's being sold out. And they had, the management was talking about how people won't go into the office, but they'll fill up a pub and say hi to their boss at the pub. But they're unwilling. They don't think it's safe to be in the office. I think, and you walk around, it's in the suburbs getting back to normal pretty quickly. Something like, was it retail sales were up 12%, hotels up 13% in the first 7 weeks of the new financial year. So in reasonable shape, it probably got a little bit ahead of itself because of the share price did, not the company, after the spin out. And it's just a matter of, where do you stand on gambling, I guess, as an investor?
Yeah.
We all shop at Dan, so.
Yeah, right. I'm going to read this, the transcript. I can see there were a few mentions of gaming in there. So, yeah right. Okay. So, that's interesting. Endeavor's, it's held widely now because of the split from Woolies. So, really interesting. Thanks for bringing that to the table, mate. So, I'll cap off with two. Simple one being Pro Medicus. ProMedicus revenue up 38% to $93 million. Profit up 44% to $44 million. Dividends, 22 cents per share of the full year, up 47%. So ProMedicus, people will know that I own shares in this company, full disclosure. ProMedicus is probably the highest quality company on the ASX. Super strong top line growth because more exams, they make money transaction revenue. So they have minimums guaranteed into their contracts with hospitals. So for those of you that don't know, ProMedicus owns the brand called Visage Imaging, which in the United States offers technology and software to hospitals and radiology clinics that allow them to stream images. So if you get a mammogram or insert any type of medical image, the ProMedicus software can stream that image instantly to a computer, to an iPad, to an iPhone. And not only that, you can send and receive, you can store it in a vendor-neutral archive. And they're starting to roll out all these products on top of that. Their technology is probably a year, 2 years ahead of the competition. It has signed some of the biggest hospitals in the world, most well-known brands like Mayo Clinic, for example. And in Australia, they continue to development for their thing called Radiology Information Services, which is commonly called RIS, R-A-S. And that is a workflow management for radiology clinics. So software that does everything from, you know, booking clients into scheduling rooms and whatever you want to do with it, basically. So ProMedicus's results are basically dependent on the contracts that it wins, how quickly it can implement, and then the usage of the technology. And so for the next 5 years, assuming renewals, ProMedicus has banked in $420 million of revenue. That's from the committed revenue over the next 5 years, plus growth. In the year to June 30th, in the US alone, transactional revenue was up 65%. So this is a business that has a bank of revenue already booked for the future, assuming their high-quality clients pay the bill, and they're re-signing clients for longer terms at higher rates, which is really, really telling. And they're also winning new sites.
It's another one I thought I wish I bought when someone bought it to me.
Yeah, it's people don't know this about ProMedicus. Yes, it's the best performing stock on the ASX over the past 10 years. But before Sam, who's the co-founder, went back, who's appeared on this podcast too, before he went back, the company wasn't doing too well. He and Anthony is he was the original programmer of the software. They actually bought Visage. So the technology, they didn't develop that themselves. They actually bought that. A group in Germany, Malt Westerhoff, still the CTO, I believe, he and his team designed that, and ProMedicus bought it. I think they bought the combined business for $15 million during the GFC. They sold part of it for $5 or $10, which left them the bit they wanted, which is now Visage, which is probably worth a few billion.
Yeah.
So
Patience,
capital allocation, you know, sticking with it. ProMedicus has done a good job. What's it worth? Probably not what today's share price is. If you do a discounted cash flow analysis, I find it pretty hard to get to. But if it can continue to grow in other modalities, it's rolling out new products, entering new verticals. It's got the AI Accelerator Lab. So there's a lot to like about it. Yeah, I still own shares from many years ago, but would be happy with a very small portion of a portfolio in it. It's just high risk.
I think it's just a reminder of the long game, isn't it? That if it's a good, you find good companies, and why trade out of them? and don't always sell you, you know, buy the ones that have fallen. Sometimes buy the ones that are rising and doing something good.
That are winning, yeah. Yeah. So my final company then, seeing that was Pro Medicus. Maybe I'll just talk about one I haven't spoken about this week, which is Laserbond, small cap company, LBL is the ticker code. Just surface engineering. So if you have a big piece of machinery or equipment, you can go to a Laserbond site and they'll repair that piece of equipment to original standard or better, up to 10 times, 20 times better in terms of wear and tear. So it's good for the environment because you reuse parts, and it's good for them because they can use their expertise in surface engineering and increasingly in cladding. The business overall, very strong result issued this morning, being August 25th, revenue up 24%, EBITDA up 36%, net profit up 28%, cash in the bank up 16%. And I think that was despite some delays in some components and delivering for some customers. They Wayne Hoopo's the family executive director and CEO of the business, major shareholder and an engineer himself. He was saying in prepared remarks that basically they had bottlenecks. They couldn't fulfill enough customer orders. So they've gone out and hired new people. So they've gone out and hired, I think it was off the top of my head, 17 new folks. This is a small cap business, by the way. So we're talking small numbers. We're not talking thousands of employees. 15 new employees who are scheduled to commence. So this basically what these employees do is it allows them to do more engineering, more throughput at the Victorian or the Queensland sites more recently. Their core manufacturing base is in Sydney. They're looking to expand into WA in a big way to get closer to mining clients and so on and so forth. And for the most part, this is a business that I think over the last few years has compounded EBITDA at something like, I don't know, strong double digits. So small cap company.
40%.
40%. There you go. They have a pretty ambitious target to reach before 2025. Just try and get it up. They want to reach $60 million of revenue by 2025. And that compares to $31 million now. So
how did you find it? I always have to ask you
that. Laserbond. Yeah. I think originally it might have been through friend of the show, Luke Winchester, or friend of the show, Andrew Page. Maybe even before that. But if you screen for small cap companies that pay a dividend.
There's not many.
And profitable. That's not in mining.
Yeah.
You're not going to get a lot of names. So this is one that's on there. And actually, that reminds me, I saw them. So I went to a mining conference here in Melbourne. I can't remember. It's the big one. I can't remember who it was. I was going there to look at a company called RPM Global. And when I was there, there was about four or five companies that were listed on the ASX, which I recognized. And I saw Laserbond there, and they had a store, and they were showcasing their technology. And so that's what initially was like, everyone talks about that thing. It sounds weird, Laserbond. Sounds like, I don't even know what that sounds like. So I went and looked at it, and that's when I was like, oh, okay, this is really interesting. It's not as complicated as I thought. And so they've got for a small cap company, they got an internal R&D function. They partner with universities. They're licensing their technology. Now, two of their three big partners for the technology division, they haven't yet built the revenue for, I believe. So I'm, you know, with a founder at the helm and a family that's very well incentivized, I think you can expect more dividends and you can expect growth over time. It's just maybe a bit of cyclicality. It's always risks in small cap businesses. So keep that in mind. Don't go in and go, I'm going to start with a 10% position of my portfolio. It's nothing crazy like that. It's just a small cap company. So I just like it, and I'm hoping I can get to Sydney in the next few months and go on tour the facility. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that's Laserbond. So just to recap the companies that we've covered, we've got Laserbond, Pro Medicus, Treasury Wines, EML Payments, and Altium in reverse order from me. From you, we had Endeavour, Coles, Hub, Kogan, and Boral.
All the interesting ones.
Oh, so much fun. well, Kogan's a bit of an interesting one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, still got the founding management team, it's a bit of a dog's breakfast at the moment, but maybe in time they can straighten out the ship.
Well, boring's good in markets too, so.
Yeah, true it is. Boral, we talk about, you know, the name says it all, but it has paid dividends consistently over the years. Endeavour, you said like more people returning to hotels.
And still going to Dan's.
Still going to Dan's. Everyone needs to go to Dan's. Laserbond, pretty good result. I got a text message from my dad before saying, what's a buy on the market at the moment? So I'll keep that one private. But I think, you know, for the most part, as I've gone through this reporting season, for the first time in a few years, I feel like it's a buyer's market in that there's a lot of volatility, a lot of uncertainty amongst investors, and things are getting sold off.
There's a lot of pessimism, seems overdone.
Yeah.
And like even before the Bank of America Fund Manager Survey was at the highest amount of pessimism in markets.
Yeah, right.
And that is always when markets rally, essentially.
Yeah. So I feel like if you've got your wits about you, we're not saying go and buy everything, but if you've got your wits about you, now it will be more fruitful. You know, whereas if you were going and researching companies and you might look at 10 companies over a month or two, you might get one.
Yeah.
But now you might get three. You know, that's probably the difference. So,
well, someone pulled out a stat that in 2020, I think it must have been on another podcast, there were 98%.
Another podcast.
It's the one we always talk about. Okay. 98. Yeah. I think it was 98% of companies in the S&P 500 went up in 2020. And that's when all the new investors joined the market. So, similar to when, there's a flood of retail investors in Australia. If 98% of the people, 98% of stocks go up, didn't matter what you bought.
Mm.
But now where it's more variable, it's much more of a buyer's market compared to that, which was in hindsight a seller's market.
I think when you get, that's a fascinating set. I feel like when you get into markets like this where it's choppy, the thing is you got to go back to basics.
Yeah.
Just look at the companies that are growing and are going to keep growing and paying dividends and doing all these things. And management team's got a sensible head. The ones that are freaking out, the ones that aren't making the hard calls, just avoid them. You don't need to worry about them. See how they go and come back another time.
Exactly.
Good list of companies here. Drew, people can get in contact with you by heading to wattlepartners.com.au, correct?
Yep. Not on Twitter.
Not on Twitter. Do you monitor LinkedIn at all?
Yep. Yeah, a lot. Right. Too much.
Yeah, right. Okay. So LinkedIn, there you go. You can find Drew on LinkedIn. I, not so much. I get some messages through LinkedIn. I'm like, month late, do I reply? But yeah, if you want to get in contact with me, there's plenty of contact forms on the Rask websites. Otherwise, you can find me on Twitter. There are a few imposter accounts. Don't worry about those guys. The real deal. At Owen Rask is the, it'll be in the
not,
show notes.
Not Rask.
Not Rask. There's a yeah. Oh, we can't get rid of him.
I reported it. I actually followed it and then reported it.
If someone that looks like me is sending you a message about trading strategies or cryptocurrencies, it is not me. It's not, definitely not me. Thank you, Instagram, for that. So, Drew Meredith, as always, thanks for joining me.
Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside RaskCore. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called RaskCore. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 RASK community members have begun the RASK plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian property podcast by RASK, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RASKCore, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nevexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASK users get 20% off an annual plan with Nevexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nevexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nevexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASK community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASK YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RAS network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that, all of that, by going to the RASC Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASC Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the, probably I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASC Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us. Because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000. And hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASC and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RAS network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.